Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hey, it's Dr. Gurr with another psychological podcast, and today's podcast is going to be a discussion with Dr. Jen Berman about her new book, The A to Z Guide to Raising Happy, Confident Kids. I have to tell you that for the longest time, I've only recommended one or two books for parenting, and this clearly has joined the ranks. I found it to be a great resource for parents. It's parent-friendly, it's straightforward, it's easy, it's rational, it makes sense, and seems to actually agree with everything I think. So you know it must be good. So before we meet Dr. Berman, who is, by the way, known as Dr. Jen, let me give you her bio. Dr. Jen Berman is a licensed marriage and family therapist in private practice in Beverly Hills, and she's been working in the field of psychology for more than 15 years. She's made appearances as a psychological expert on more than 100 television shows, including The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, Intervention, 48 Hours, and The Tyra Banks Show. She's been heard on various different radio stations, including on her call-in advice show called On the Couch. Her Dr. Jen column, which is printed in Los Angeles Family Magazine and four other magazines, won the 2005 Parenting Publication of America Silver Medal in the area of child development and parenting. She's been quoted as an expert in such publications as the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, U.S. Weekly, the Boston Herald, Cosmopolitan Magazine, Chicago Tribune, Good Housekeeping, and Parents Magazine. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband and two children, and she's done consulting for child-oriented organizations such as A Minor Consideration, the Actors Fund, and USA Gymnastics. Her website is www.drjen.com. That's spelled DocTorJenn.com. And now, let's meet Dr. Jen. Dr. Jen, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
That's terrific. You know, I read your book, The A to Z Guide to Raising Happy, Confident Kids. And I have to tell you, it's up on my list now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think it's a very straightforward, parent-friendly, clear-cut book that speaks to a lot of problems that we're having with kids these days. And I guess my first question after that would be, why did you write the book?
You know, I wrote the book for a number of reasons. I have been writing a parenting column for a few magazines, Los Angeles Family Magazine. It's reprinted in five other family magazines on the West Coast. And I've been writing this column for about 8 years. And when I became a parent, I really was looking around at all the books that are out there and looking for books with really simple, usable tools that I could use as a parent, and I didn't find it. And so I figured I better write it, and I'm an obsessive researcher. And so I really pulled together what I feel are the 26 most important topics, one for each letter of the alphabet for parents. And I wanted each chapter to stand on its own so the busy parents could pick up the book, look up a chapter that they had a concern about, whether it was sleeping or childhood fears or food issues or self-esteem or whatever it might be, and pick up the book and be able to read it and walk away with some usable tips and then be able to be done with it. And I really tried to make sure that I backed things up with research, that I use vignettes, and that I also gave very specific tips and tools for parents to use.
And I think you did a great job, because that's exactly how the book hit me. And I was reading the book and saying to myself, it's a real straightforward, common sense approach, and you explain it in such a way that I think, anyone can pick it up and use it. So kudos to you.
One of the things I really enjoy doing, both in my column and in my writing, is I love getting a lot of really complex information that when I first read it is overwhelming, and then kind of narrowing it down to, like, what do parents really need to know? What do people really need to know? What's the most important thing about this? And putting it in much easier terms so I can understand it, right, but I also find that my readers understand it and enjoy it too.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So what are some of the biggest mistakes parents are making these days, raising their children?
Well, I would say that probably the number one biggest mistake that I see is parents who are so worried about being their child's friend, and oftentimes it's a result of having had the opposite experience with their own parents, mm-hmm. but that a lot of today's parents just want to be liked by their kids and want to be their kids' friends. And, you know, some of that comes from a good place. I want my kid to be able to talk to me. I want them to be able to share their concerns and anxieties. I want to really be a resource for my kid, and that's healthy. But a lot of parents today have taken it to an extreme where they're not making firm, consistent boundaries with their kids. And it's really easy to let it go, especially when you have worked all day, you're tired, you come home, and your kid is pushing the limits, you know. And I always give the simple example of, you say to your child, if you throw the ball in the house, I'm going to take the ball away from you. Mm-hmm. And you come home after a long day, you've been stuck in traffic, you're cooking dinner, and your child throws the ball in the house, but it doesn't break anything. It's really easy in that moment to say, next time you do it, I'll take the ball away. But mm-hmm. when you do that, what you teach your child is, I don't really mean what I say. The rules don't apply to you. And we've seen a lot of very entitled people, especially celebrities over the past few years, think that the rules didn't apply to them and end up in jail. Mm-hmm. And, well, your child's not going to end up in jail because you didn't take the ball away. They will push the boundaries more. When you say one thing and you do another, they're always going to test you over and over again, and kids actually want limits. As much as they kick and scream and complain about it, they really want limits. I've actually had kids in my office, believe it or not, even teenagers, who have said to me, I wish my parents would give me a curfew. I wish they cared that much. Or I wish that they were actually looking out for me. I wish that they were up when I came home so I knew that they cared.
Mm. You know, in my practice, I work with families, and I have the kids there while I discuss the parenting issues with the children and the parents in the same room. And I do that because I want the children to know what my game plan is. And mm-hmm. we come up many times with a game plan that there's a rational and reasonable consequence to a behavior. And the next mm-hmm. week, the family will come in. And I've had kids as young as 5 or 6 tell me, mm-hmm. you know, Dr. Gurr, you told them to do this, and they didn't do it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
the parents are stunned, yeah. And I look at the parents and I go, yeah. "See, even he knew yep. that was what happened."
And I think it's so interesting, and you know what you're saying really speaks to how much kids want limits. They want to know their parents care. And they also, limits make kids feel safe. If you think about driving on the road, mm-hmm. if I were to take away all of the lines on the road, all of the stop signs and stop lights, it would be terrifying to drive because we wouldn't know what the rules are, what the boundaries are, and it would be a very anxiety provoking experience to drive. Mm-hmm. It's the same way for kids. When they don't know the rules of the house, it's anxiety provoking. It feels like everything is out of control. And when kids know what they can expect, they feel much safer, and it really gives them the room to thrive in other areas of their life.
Mm. You know, one of the things that comes across my office many times is kids who have what I consider self-esteem issues, but in the wrong direction that most people would perceive it. And
sure.
Because I see kids where parents did everything they possibly could to mm-hmm. bolster their kid's self-esteem to the point where it's unrealistic. And
sure.
I tell parents, you know, sometimes self-esteem is overrated because these kids have no idea what it is to maybe fail at something. Mm-hmm. How do you pick yourself up? How do you cope with something? If parents are constantly making sure that the children don't ever experience a disappointment.
And I'm so glad that you brought this up because I couldn't agree with you more. And I have a whole chapter in my book, The A to Z Guide to Raising Happy, Confident Kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about self-esteem. And I think that there's a lot of misguided parents who think that giving your kid good self-esteem is praising them all the time. It's telling them they're always wonderful. It's protecting them from losing. And there are a lot of schools now who won't have valedictorians because they're afraid the kids will get their feelings hurt, or sports teams that don't keep score. But the truth is, more than anything, even more than winning, our kids need to know how to lose, and they need to know how to fail. And that, you know, quote-unquote failing is one of the most valuable learning experiences that kids can have. Because when they fail, they're able to develop the skills to adjust their learning process. It's like a game of darts. Every time you throw a dart, you're aiming for the center, when you miss, you alter your next throw based on your previous throw. It's the same thing in life. When we fail in life, when we make a mistake, we need to base our next choice on what happened before. And kids need to face the consequences of their actions so that they can have that experience and alter it. And not to mention, adversity leads to growth. Mm-hmm. You know, kids can't grow if they can't face adversity, and they're not going to be resilient. You know, kids need to, a kid with really great self-esteem is able to see what their strengths are and their weaknesses are, and they're able to say, this is an area I need to work on. Mm-hmm. And that's really great self-esteem. You know, they also need to know that they will be accepted and loved by their parents whether they win or lose. And that's also important for parents to model to their kids. But I think that there are just so many misunderstandings about self-esteem.
When I do, say, a kind of a therapy with a child, a young child, and I'm playing a game with them, and generally what my mm-hmm. approach is to play the game as if I was another kid, so that they get a sense about what happens if I cheat, or what happens if I play unfairly. You know, will the other kid not want to play with me anymore? Will I lose that connection? And I have parents who say, well, when I play with my child, I always let them win. And I make sure that they win because it makes them feel good. And what I do is I play the game to the best of my ability.
Sure.
And invariably what happens is the child's going to lose in the beginning. But after a while, the child figures me out and literally beats me. And that's so much better, I think, for self-esteem, that the child learns that they legitimately would beat me. Meanwhile, they learned how to deal with failure in the beginning. And so, you know, I don't want to...
And also, they become a better player because you give them the room.
Right.
And they get to watch you play well, so they learn how to play better.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, like you said, they learn to tolerate the experience of not winning, which is so important.
And I teach them what they did wrong.
Sure.
On the way, go. You see how I beat you over there? That's because you did this. Now, if you did this way, you would beat me. And so I literally teach them the skills. But I would also act like another child. If they cheated, I would say, you know, that's it. I don't want to play with you anymore until the next time they come in. And so they learn that the way they handle a game may affect a peer, because an adult will handle them very differently than a child of their own age.
Sure. And also what you're teaching them is the consequences to their actions,
mm-hmm.
that when they cheat, people don't want to play with them. It makes them less likely to cheat.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of which, I know you've touched on this, about helping children become good decision makers. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that particular concept?
Absolutely, and it really is very much along the lines of self-esteem and of letting children make mistakes. That, you know, decision-making skills are one of the most important skills that we can help our children develop, because it is the thing that will determine whether they're healthy or unhealthy, whether they go to the gym, what job they have, whether they pick a good mate, who their friends are, whether they drink and drive. It's all that sort of stuff. So we really need to give our kids the opportunity to make decisions as early as possible. And obviously, at a very young age, it needs to be small decisions. Do you want, you know, the pink dress or the green dress? Do you want the, you know, these shoes or those shoes? Do you want the apple or the banana? But as they get older, we need to give them the room to make decisions. And even when they're ones that we don't like, as long as their safety is not compromised, but we need to let them have the room to do that, because also for kids, decision making is self-defining. Am I the boy who likes the blue baseball hat or the green baseball hat? Oh, okay, I'm the blue baseball hat kind of guy. And it's very self-defining. Even decisions that seem really benign and unimportant to parents are a big deal for kids. Mm-hmm. It's autonomy.
Right. You know, the big question in my office many times is the issue of siblings and sibling rivalry, and how do you handle siblings and sibling rivalry? And you know, I have my own feelings about it, and I think your book is pretty much on the same page as I am. So maybe we could talk about how to handle sibling rivalry so that parents could understand this from a more rational perspective.
Well, I think that one of the most important things for parents to understand is that children are competing for resources.
Mm-hmm.
That as much as they love each other, ultimately, as much as they have positive feelings about their family, that they're competing for love, attention, even sometimes money, material goods, sometimes even food, and that of course kids will fight with each other, of course kids will compete, of course kids will have issues with each other, and it's up to us to try to create as much harmony as possible, but also to recognize that these are really normal reactions. It's like Adele Farber in her book Siblings Without Rivalry talks a lot about if your husband came home one day and said, I love you very much, but I brought home another wife. You need to share your makeup and your clothes, all your clothes that you don't wear that much. We're going to give to her. And, you know, don't worry. I love you just as much as her. She's going to have dinner with us. We're going to spend all our time with her, too. Well, what person would respond well to that? No one would. And it's the same thing for children, that when you bring home a new baby, it's very invasive to the first child, and that, you know, we really have to make sure that we are sensitive to that. And also, you know, it's very important to spend one-on-one time with our kids. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very easy to just operate as a family, to just do everything together or not do enough together, but kids really need one-on-one time, even if it's just 10 minutes before bedtime, if that's all you've got, to sit down together and say, you know, how was your day? What was your favorite part of your day? What was your least favorite part of your day? It's very important for kids.
You know, I don't know if you ever came across this, but there were studies a couple of years ago comparing the typical working mother versus the typical non-working mother in terms of how much time that they actually spend one-to-one with their children per day.
And what did the study reveal? I've never seen that one.
Well, and I've used this concept a lot because I have mothers who will tell me, oh, I wish I could spend more time with my child. And I'll say, well, how much time do you spend? About 2 hours. And I say, well, all right, well, I'm going to give you the basic data that I have. And sure, the reality is that the typical working mother spends 11 minutes per day with their child individually. And I'm talking about being in the same room, you know, I'm cooking and you're playing. I'm talking about really one-to-one individual time.
Face-to-face, sure.
Right. And the typical non-working mother spends 13 minutes. And this kind of came out. I was on a radio show years ago with there was a case here in New York, upstate, where a mother was a physician and her nanny was convicted of murder because she shook the baby to death while the mother was at work. And there were people saying, well, if the mother wasn't working, this never would have happened. And I was on the radio saying, well, you know, these people can talk all they want, but let's really look at the data. And the data indicates that people who are not working aren't spending too much time with their kids either.
But also, so it's interesting to me that people rush to point the finger at the mother. Well, what about saying, why isn't the dad at home? Why does it always have to be the mother?
Sure. Yeah, but, you know, as far as we progressed, I think the division of labor still hasn't, you know, reached 50-50 yet. But then that leads me to my next question, which is parents as role models. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that
the pressure is on. I mean, it's really it is amazing how much kids pick up on and how they repeat everything. A while back, this is a funny story. I have twin girls, as you and I talked about earlier, right. And this is a while back. They were a little under 2 years old. And every Friday night we do a dinner, my husband and I, with both of my parents. And my father walked in. My kids were kind of playing on the floor in the kitchen, and we were all just hanging out. And he handed me a bottle of wine and said, "Oh, are you? I brought some wine. It's a really good bottle. Would you like a glass of wine?" And I jokingly said to him after a long day, "I'd like a big bottle of wine." And we all kind of laughed, and I didn't think twice. And we had our evening. And the next morning, I go into my daughter's room and I say, "Hello. Good morning." And both my daughters, in unison, they're not even 2 years old at this point, say, "Mama, I want a big bottle of wine." Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, they don't miss a thing. Yeah. And I think of myself as someone who's really quite careful about what I say in front of my kids and very, very aware. But it really, like, I didn't even remember saying it at the time. It was just kind of so in passing. But kids notice everything. Every word we speak, everything that we do, we are their role models. Mm-hmm. And the pressure is on them. And I often have to think to myself, you know, even when my kids aren't around, I often think to myself, I was in a situation recently where I was at the gym and there was a conflict that came up, and I thought, what kind of mom do I want my kids to see? The mom who does A or the mom who does B? What's a better role model for my kids? And it's something that once you become a parent that you have to think about all the time, because you are always their role model, always.
And I think in connection to that, I think it's important for parents to understand that how they resolve conflicts with each other is significant, because that teaches their children how do I compromise? How do I resolve a conflict? How do I argue healthfully? How do I, you know, argue in such a way that there's a healthy conclusion? How do I not become abusive when I argue? And, you know, parents, they almost sometimes treat their children, again, like they don't know what's going on, or they're ignorant, or
They yell in front of them, and they have conversations in front of them that the child knows that they're talking about something either about them or something that is very interesting to them, and they do it in front of them, and it's disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's important to have really respectful communication with our kids, because that's also role modeling. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of the time parents say, especially with young kids, how do I get my child to say please and thank you? You do it by doing it with them, by role modeling.
Right.
You know, it means nothing to a child when you say I'm sorry, and the child just says, I'm sorry. It's meaningless. Mm-hmm. But when your child sees you say, I'm really sorry, Mama lost her temper, and I raised my voice. I really didn't like the way I talked to you, and it looked like I scared you. I'm really sorry I talked to you that way. That's not the way Mama wants to talk to you.
That's an interesting point that I have found over the years. You know, parents make mistakes because they're imperfect, and parenting is an imperfect vocation.
Yes.
It's just a very difficult thing to do. And what I tell my parents all the time is, look, you're going to make mistakes, and the biggest thing that I've always found is if you're a parent who admits your humanness to your mm-hmm. children, then your children
– Yeah.
Children, yeah, they will understand and forgive. But if you come across like you're perfect all the time, even when you know you've made a grievous error in front of your child, but you won't admit it, what you're telling the child is that you're not real.
Yep.
And they can't trust you.
Sure.
And they become angry and resentful. But they will never become resentful if you become a human being to them.
And also, not to mention, I was actually talking with a colleague of mine, Allison Latona, who's also a parenting expert, who was saying that there was a study that came out, a Daniel Siegel study, that talked about when parents apologize to their children, that it's actually reparative in terms of the neurologically, that it's a very calming force, and it's so important that when we do wrong, that we apologize. And that talk about role modeling, you know, that's really some of the best role modeling that we can do.
Right. I had another question for you about an issue that comes up a lot in therapy, and that is how do you teach children about money? You know,
sure.
And people always say, well, I give them an allowance or I give them money when they really want it or when I think they need it. And I've always had issues with teaching children the value of money. And even with my own kids, I mean, I started very early on. I remember my son was 5, and we had taken a book out from the library, mm-hmm. and a month later we found it in his room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was 5, and I said, okay. And he had a little piggy bank with his little money in it. And I said, okay, there's a fine now that we have to pay. And whatever that fine is, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to be responsible for, because that book was due, you know, a while ago. And so I think the fine was $1 or something like that.
Sure.
And we sat down and we took the dollar out of his piggy bank.
Mm-hmm. And I bet he was never late returning a library book ever again.
No, he never was.
Yeah.
No.
And you know, that's also a great example of teaching children the consequences of their actions. And I really am a big believer in giving kids allowances. In the A to Z Guide to Raising Happy, Confident Kids, mm-hmm. I have a whole chapter on money, and I talk about the signs that your child is ready for an allowance. And some of them are that they're aware of the relationship between money and purchasing. They can differentiate between coins. They know that a nickel is worth 5 cents, a quarter is worth 25 cents. You know, a lot of the time, really young kids will want a nickel over a dime because it's bigger. Mm-hmm. But when they're able to understand that, that's a sign. When they're able to count, add, and subtract, and also when they have opportunities for spending, and when they start to ask, when you're at the store and they start to say, I want that toy, I want that gum, I want that candy, and also when they ask for an allowance. So any combination of those, that means that your child is ready for an allowance. And I really recommend that parents give their children an allowance as soon as they see these signs. And they give them responsibility that comes with the allowance. So it's not just, here's some money, you get $5 a week, and there's a lot of different information out there about, do you give them half their age per week, their whole age, plus a dollar. There's a whole range, and you really have to look at your own particular family. But even more importantly, you have to look at, what is your child now going to be responsible for? And what is appropriate for a child this age to be responsible for? And it's very fair if you've got a 5-year-old to say, anytime we're at the supermarket and you want something, it's up to you. You can have that thing, but it comes from your allowance.
Right.
Suddenly, when it's their money, they start asking a whole lot less. And one of the most important things with money, and talk about decision-making skills, is that parents need to give their kids enough money so that they can save up for things, they can actually afford to purchase things, that they can actually use the money to learn from, but also not so much that if they blow it, that it will be devastating to the family, that it will be a significant financial loss. Because learning about money is a lot like driving a car. You wouldn't give your child a car and expect, just be like, here are the keys, you've never been in a car before, go have fun. You know they've crashed the car. It's the same thing with an allowance. They're going to make mistakes, and the time for them to make mistakes is during childhood. It's a huge mistake to send your child off to college and say, oh, here's an allowance, or here's some money, or God forbid, here's a credit card. Because what ends up happening is debt, debt, debt. And we are a real debt society. We want to teach our kids early on about money and about consequences to behaviors and about choices and about saving and spending and even ultimately investing and being charitable.
You're right. You're right. And even with my kids, as I said, I started young, and both my kids, who are now teenagers, have learned over the years to, you know, when they want something that's over and above what I'm willing to give them, you know, they want a pair of sneakers. I'm willing to pay $80 for a pair of sneakers, but my son may want a sneaker, a set of sneakers, or a pair of sneakers, or
$20.
Right.
Sure.
He knows. He's automatic.
Sure.
I'll kick in the rest, and that's been for years.
And I think that that is so smart. I had a woman in my practice recently come up to me, and she said to me, you know, my daughter wants these $150 jeans. And I said, what do you think what is an appropriate amount to spend on jeans in your house? And she said, you know, I'd be willing to spend, I'd spend $80. I said, okay, that's very generous of you. So the rest, let her save for it. And if they're really important to her, she'll save up and she'll buy the jeans and she'll treat them really well. And if it's not that important to her, well, then she'll find some $80 jeans that she likes. And I think that it's really, it's very true. And I think that kids feel differently about things that they save up for.
Exactly. Because they own them and they understand the value of it, because it took time to get it, as opposed to just, you know, magically appearing because they just wished for it.
And there's pride in it. There's pride in saving up and having the patience to do that, and also even the anticipation. Obviously, it has to be age appropriate. Your 5-year-old can't, you know, save for a year. Just developmentally, they're not able to hold the image in their head long enough. But your 16-year-old sure can.
Dr. Jen, unfortunately, we're out of time. I know we could talk for hours on this topic, but we don't have the time to do that.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your wonderful show.
Oh, thank you. And I wanted to remind everybody that you have a website. It's www.drjen.com. And they could find
you. DOCTORJENN.
They could find your book. On Amazon. It's The A to Z Guide to Raising Happy, Confident Kids by Dr. Jen Berman. And again, I want to thank you. And I hope my audience has profited from your wisdom. because I believe that this book is definitely a great find.
Thank you.
Until next time, this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.